Hello there, Richard here. In my last recording, I was talking about some engravings that I'd bought at auction, and I mentioned that I'd hung them in my house in Suffolk. So today, I thought I would show you around the village that the house is set in. For many years, we lived in a large Georgian house in London. Some of you might have stayed there, but that's another story. As the last millennium came and went, we decided a change was needed. So we sold the house and moved into a modern apartment near the south bank of the Thames. St Paul's was in view and Borough Market was our local provider of food. However, we always knew that another period house outside London was something we sought. Whilst on holiday, we were idly flicking through one of those property sites, as you do, and we suddenly saw this beautiful house in a little village not far from where we had friends in Suffolk. Needless to say, by the time we returned and got in touch with the agent, it was under offer. So we forgot all about it. Or did we? Sometime later, we were driving up to visit our friends and thought it might be interesting to see the village where this house had been located, just in case something else might be on the market. We eventually found the village and, to our amazement, there was a for sale sign outside the very house. Seemingly, a few days before, the proposed purchaser had withdrawn their offer, so the house was up for sale again. We viewed, we fell in love, we purchased. From London, it takes about an hour and a half to drive to the village. Luckily, there are no motorways, so hordes of people rarely venture up here. We pass Colchester, which in Roman times was the capital of England. Our village was actually the largest settlement in Suffolk at that time, but today it's a sleepy little place, thankfully cut off from the busy through roads that lead you up to Norfolk. Your first sight of the village is over the fields, where the tower of the Norman church appears through the trees, over a little humpback bridge, and the church appears again on your right. Opposite, a terrace of workers' cottages, dating from the 14th century, now all beautifully spruced up. Passing these, you come to Manor Farm, which, when we first moved to the village about a dozen years ago, was lived in by the most eccentric but kind old lady. She had a small herd of red poll cows that grazed in the fields behind the farm, and each morning she would bring you fresh milk. She loved amateur theatricals and liked nothing better than to regale you with a song or two. In previous years, she had organised a pantomime each Christmas for the delight of the village children, but I think most of the village seemed to have been roped in to perform, so I'm not sure exactly how many sat and watched the show. Sadly, she passed away recently, but as the hearse drove through the village, everyone came out of their houses to give her one last standing ovation. On the other side of the road is another big old farmhouse, which actually owned the land that our house was built on. It was originally a small house owned by some yeoman farmer, but over the centuries it has been extended and refurbished many times. I expect it was originally thatched, judging by the pitch of the roof, as would all the village have been. By the time you get to the mid-1700s, so the story goes, there were two sisters living there who decided they wanted to build a new home, similar to the ones they had seen in the bigger towns. So, as was often the custom in those days, they bought a set of plans, off the shelf, so to speak, of the sort of house that they wanted, and then commissioned a local builder to start work. The idea being that once the house was finished, they would pull down the farmhouse and move into their new smart abode. Alas, once the house was completed, they fell out. So only one sister moved in, and the old farmhouse was never pulled down. Anyway, a little further on, the road divides. The main part goes off to the right, and straight on is a little lane. The building on the corner, with a small green in front of it, was once a large coaching inn with stables at the rear. This was originally a private house, the owner of which fought at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415. He was subsequently knighted by King Henry V, and part of his coat of arms was a griffin. A griffin, by the way, is a legendary creature with the body, tail and back legs of a lion, the head and wings of an eagle, and sometimes an eagle's talons as its front feet, often used in heraldry. By the reign of King James I in the early 1600s, it had established itself as an inn under the sign of the Griffin. All pubs had to be named by 1393, when by law an ale inspector was appointed to check on the strength and quality of the beer. But many people of the time couldn't read and write, so the sign came into use, hand-painted and reflecting the name. In the latter part of the 1600s, the pub changed its name to The Crown to celebrate the return of the monarch, Charles II, after the puritanical Cromwell had been our protector. During this time, the main form of public transport was by horse-drawn carriage. Often six horses were used to pull the large carriages, but about every 7 miles they would have had to be rested or changed, and so sprung up the coaching inn, with stables at the back. Our pub sign is no longer on the little green, but in its place is our village sign, made of wrought iron. The central part shows the rays of the sun beaming down onto our Norman church. Below this, a Roman helmet, connecting the village with Roman times, a windmill, which used to be on the hill behind the inn, and a pig. Now, the pig celebrates one of the rectors of our church, Nicholas Bacon. The Bacon family goes back to the Elizabethan period, when he was the Lord Keeper of the Great Seal. Today he would have been our Lord Chancellor. When the coaching inn was finally closed down, they divided it up into two houses. The main part, which faces you, has a very fine room where the assizes met 4 times a year. These were like law courts where the travelling judges oversaw the more serious criminal cases. Many the time I have sat in that very room, which has a heavily beamed ceiling, a blazing log fire set in a big inglenook fireplace, thankfully though, with a drink in my hand and good company, as today it's a fine sitting room. At the back of the inn was a wooden barn. In 1918, it was given to the village so that the soldiers returning from the First World War would have somewhere to meet, and a snooker table was donated for them to play on. In later years, money was raised, and they bought the part of the inn that it was attached to, and so came about the country club. In the early days, there was a doctor's surgery on the ground floor, and above were the rooms of the club. Today, most of us in the village are members, and we come here to play billiards or the odd game of darts, perhaps even have a flutter on one of the one-armed bandits. The bar, though, has excellent ale and a convivial atmosphere, so it's a great asset for the village. If you look further up the high street, as it climbs the hill, you see a number of fine wooden-framed houses, mostly from the 16th and early 17th century, with their fronts jetting over the road. Jetting is a building technique used in medieval timber frame buildings in which an upper floor projects beyond the dimensions of the floor below. This has the advantage of increasing the available space in the building without obstructing the street. During the 1800s, there were numerous shops up there set within the old houses, but today we have but one, which is down here on the left opposite the old coaching inn. When we arrived in the village, it was a grocery store, come butchers, with a post office at the side, owned and run by one family for generations. You'd enter, and one of the ladies would bustle up to you and ask what she could get for you. None of this help-yourself nonsense, you notice. The village sausages were famous, but it was when the farm decided to have one of their cows slaughtered that the village jungle drums would sound and a word would be dropped in our proprietor's ear that a joint for the weekend would be much appreciated. As a townie, I found it strange to be one day walking through the meadows and admiring these lovely animals, and a week or so later, well, I soon learned that here in the country, this is the natural rhythm of life, And if you're going to eat meat, how much better to know that the animal was probably born on the farm, eating grass that had not been sprayed with insecticide and had been well cared for. The ladies of the shop couldn't have been kinder to us. And soon there was a knock on our door and a lovely young lady stood there telling us she had been sent over as they thought we would need a cleaning lady. Oh, how right they were. A few years later, she became pregnant and decided to stop work. Needless to say, our ladies at the shop busied themselves to find us a replacement, which they did, a wonderful lady who had been born here in the village. And today she not only looks after the house, but is a fund of good advice and many stories of the village as it was in the past. Today, our shop is a community shop run by volunteers from the village. It has a small cafe attached, closed, of course, at the moment, where gossip changes hand on a daily basis. And there is a good selection of locally sourced fruit and vegetables and cheeses, a daily delivery of bread from a nearby bakery, and all the normal goods you'd expect from a small grocery store. In so many other villages, they have lost their shop, so we consider ourselves lucky to have retained ours. On the corner opposite the shop, behind a large hedge, stands my house. So come on over and have a look. You enter the garden by a wrought iron gate. There are a couple of tall yew trees on either side of a gravel path that leads up to the house. The art of gardening had developed considerably in the 17th century, so a well-kept garden was now considered to be an important aspect of the house. Ours has four segmented beds with a stone obelisk in the middle. There is a hedge on two sides and a wall covered in climbing hydrangeas on the other. The garden is dominated, though, by a cherry tree, which at the moment is showering me and the garden with pink confetti. Every other year, the village has a tradition of open gardens, which takes place one Sunday in June, where a number of private gardens are open to the public to raise funds for our church. Plants are sold, some offer tea and coffee, and lunch is served in the village hall. We also have a scarecrow competition. The Egyptians were the first to use scarecrows to protect wheat fields along the Nile River from flocks of quail. Today, our scarecrows tend to be dressed in more and more outlandish costumes, but the children love them. The house itself is of red brick, double-fronted and having a handsome front door which is approached by five wide stone steps, an iron balustrade on either side. It's a typical house of the mid-1700s, with fine sash windows on the upper ground and first floors. But it also has windows to the half-basement, and in the roof there is a further small dormer window. Looking above the front door is a lovely fanlight. These became popular during the 1700s. Before this, there would have been no natural light in the hallway, so they were often dark and needed candles burning. But with a semicircular window fitted above the door, with glazing bars radiating out like a fan, your privacy was kept, but natural light was let in. As you ascend the steps, notice the boot scrapers set into the ironwork, a necessity here at that time, with horses being the main form of transport and many animals being driven up the main street, so your footwear was often muddy. Well, I seem to have run out of time. So do join me again, and I'd be delighted to show you around the house. Until the next time, this is Richard Redhat, signing off.